Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Greater New York Hospital Association General Line Collaborative Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Hillary Jalon. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us after the long holiday weekend. And we'll just get right into the agenda. We have a few housekeeping items to go through after we get to the two main presentations for this, and we'll also have a question-and-answer session. We'll start off the call today with Karen Scott Collins. Karen is the Deputy Chief Medical Officer of New York City's Health and Hospitals Corporation, and they've been involved in a critical care collaborative, which is partially funded by the United Hospital Fund, and they've been doing that since February of 2005. And Karen today is going to share some of their experiences since they've started with the project and go through things like senior leadership involvement and the sustainability of their efforts. So without further ado, Karen.
Okay. Thank you, Hillary.
Sure.
I appreciate the chance to be part of the call this afternoon. I think you sent around the slides, so I'll just I'm going to kind of talk off of the PowerPoint presentation. And let me know if you can hear me okay. I'm kind of moving the phone around a little bit.
Okay. You sound good from here. Okay,
thanks. Hopefully people were able to open the presentation. I'm just going to start with a little bit of background. About 2 years ago, for the first time across HHC, we started to bring the directors of our ICUs together to begin to look at a range of topics related to quality improvement and outcomes, as well as utilization and use of resources in the intensive care unit. out of that work, one of the major activities that developed was using the director's network to support a broader effort on a range of quality improvement areas. We kind of more formalized this earlier this year using the improvement collaborative methodologies from used by IHI, we'll present some of what we've been working on and what we're kind of learning along the way. As Hillary said, we started in February, so we're about 6 months into the team's really working. But just to continue with the background, the Critical Care Directors Network began meeting regularly about 2 years ago. The overall goal of focusing on outcomes, improving our outcomes for critical care patients across all of our hospitals, was very much a focus at a systems level. And the interest from the leadership at HHC, centrally, as well as the network, was a focus on consistent evidence-based care across our critical care unit. In addition to the ICU directors from the adult intensive care units from medicine and surgery, we also included within the directors leadership from nursing, pharmacy, and some hospital administrators so that we could have a bit more complete perspective on some of the different issues that we needed to look at. As I said, the main focus has been on the how we can consistently apply evidence-based practices and interventions to improve patient outcomes. And again, not only how we consistently do it within one of our facilities or within one unit, but how we do it 11 times or 22 times if you count each unit separately within each of the hospitals. that certainly has required us to pull a lot of resources together or make resources as we go along related to measurement and data collection. What part of the value, though, of being part of a large system, as many of you probably know, is that it really is an opportunity both to share and discuss some of that data, however good or bad it is, but also to share experiences, implementing practices, and making changes in care, and to continue that sharing as you develop and test new interventions, or as the research and literature evolves, and there are new areas to really focus on in terms of moving from research to practice. When we looked at kind of our current level of practice across the corporation about a year and a half ago, and with respect to some key patient safety and quality interventions such as using central line bundle or ventilator bundle, what we saw, not surprisingly, was that there was a lot of variation across the improvement across the corporation, and it was fair to say, again, at a systems level, room for improvement if what we wanted was to see very consistent practice everywhere. But what we also saw was that there were some hospitals that had focused a lot on a central line bundle, but not on the ventilator bundle, and vice versa, so that there were even within the corporation a lot of areas to learn from each other. The other value of meeting more with all of the directors of the network certainly was to identify barriers and related to critical care delivery that perhaps would be more effectively dealt with at the system level rather than at an individual unit or hospital level. And just to finish up on the background, certainly a lot of the areas that we looked at, that we began looking at and discussing in terms of improvement and evidence base, or are the sorts of ones listed there and from our patient safety report, and really form the basis for the areas that we've focused on ultimately in the collaborative. So by the end of last year, we had begun to really formalize into use the network as a basis for formalizing into an improvement collaborative, with a focus on, again, on the goals of improving patient outcomes, and using many of the methods that you're also using in this collaborative in terms of monthly reports. We have a dedicated intranet site for that reporting, but also continuing to our regular meetings with the network directors as a way of reporting and following up and discussing progress. We're also conducting learning sessions and using a corporate intranet site that's been developed to both to share the data and results of the improvement teams as well as to build a resource across the corporation for references and tools related to critical care practice. So we've developed measures and goals related to both some of the processes of care that we wanted to focus on as well as patient outcomes. In terms of processes of care, the goals include compliance with the ventilator bundle and the central line bundle, also using multidisciplinary rounds and using the daily goal sheet as in some form as a way of focusing on the need on the importance of communication within the unit. In terms of outcomes, teams are monthly are following on a monthly basis the ventilator days, the ICU length of stay, mortality rate, the ventilator-associated pneumonia, and the catheter-related bloodstream infections. With the goal on those to go 6 months without without one of those events, pneumonia or infection rate, stretch goal. So far we've done two learning sessions. As Hillary mentioned, we started in about mid-February with introducing the work to across the corporation and putting together multidisciplinary teams to work in these areas. Teams have mostly focused on the central line and ventilator bundle. However, in an area where there's also been a fair amount of activity and testing and development has been around insulin protocols and glycemic control. We're starting to follow some teams as they measure glycemic control more. There has been increased use and attention to daily goal sheets and other forms of improving communication in the unit and some increased use of multidisciplinary rounds, but a lot of continued challenges there, certainly in terms of being able to sustain them with respect to having the availability of particular staff to be on the rounds, particularly for us pharmacy staff is challenging. The last thing that we're just beginning to see is starting to engage other parts of the hospital to participate and make similar changes in their practices. So for a couple of our hospitals, they've begun to have discussions or engage staff from the emergency department to also use the central line bundle, and as well as to begin discussions with them on some of the work around improving sepsis outcomes. We, in terms of the methods, just to briefly mention again, there's a lot of focus on collecting the data, which continues to be a challenge for some of the hospitals. But we do have a standardized set of measures and guidance collecting the data, and we are looking at as much data as we can get from the teams on a monthly basis to track what we're doing. I think two of the big challenges for the teams have been collecting the data on some of the process measures, like such as compliance with the central line bundle, is really an additional piece of work in terms of data collection that hasn't is getting added to their usual workload and other areas that they're already collecting data on. So for some of the teams, it's taken them a little while to figure out how to measure that compliance. Secondly, we have variation across the hospitals with respect to getting the infection data, particularly getting it in a real time, very timely manner, and that is continues to be one that we're trying to work on with each of the hospitals and figure out how we can help support getting more timely data. We are using the model for improvement and encouraging as many small tests of change, as many TDSAs as possible, and really trying to push the idea of the value of doing very small tests and doing multiple tests in around very short time frames as a way of really fine-tuning a change and how to get a change into practice before trying to put it in place on a large scale and potentially upsetting a lot of people. Multiple tests particularly we see is in terms of developing something like the insulin protocols, in addition to figuring out whether or not the protocol will work and whether or not the nurse can manage the workload that might come with it, something like that. It's also been a way of gaining more buy-in, particularly from the nursing staff, but from other medical staff as well, and involving more people and more staff in developing support for a change in practice through doing the small tests. In addition to testing the idea, though, it's also important to remember that PDSAs are also an opportunity to test some of the staffing questions. Test whether there is more than one person or more than one type of role in the ICU that can do a particular task or aspect of a task related to a ventilator bundle or central line bundle. Interestingly, I think we're also seeing that the testing potential variations across different shifts has provided some good learning across some of our teams. So what worked very well as an insulin protocol during the day in one of our hospitals didn't work nearly as well at night on a different shift where there was fewer nursing support, fewer medical support, and more concerns from the nurses who were there about what to do if there was a problem with the patient. On our next slide, we're just beginning to pull together what we're seeing from reports, from senior leader reports, in terms of some of the early signs of improvement. And I've noted just a couple on the next slide. As we look really from the period from about March to July, we're starting to see more of our hospitals doing well with the central line bundle. For hospitals who hadn't been working with the bundle at all before the collaborative started are now over 90% of their patients with lines receiving all components of the bundle. Two of those hospitals also, we have the earliest signs of some declines in the infection rate with one of the hospitals not having any central line infections for the past 2 months. So hopefully that's a sign that we're moving in the right direction, and it will continue. And similarly to hospitals who had not been doing any work with the or using the ventilator bundle, also making very good progress and now above 90% compliance there. And again, an early sign of some downward trend on ventilator days. See there. Excuse me. So I'm going to just switch and for the next couple of minutes focus on what we're doing and engaging senior leadership. For us, as we focus on our whole system kind of all at once, having the support of senior leadership is really critical. Critical in making sure we can even get all of our improvement teams together at one time, and for them to know this is a support, highly supported activity. But certainly becomes more critical as we look past any initial improvement, initial changes, and look towards sustaining those changes in the units that are currently a focus. And what that will take in terms of supporting either different allocations of resources within the critical care areas, certainly with respect to supporting any additional resource needs in terms of staffing or other equipment or different equipment that may come out of this. And finally, that leadership is going to be critical in helping the initial improvement teams and the ICU directors in spreading these changes and improvements to other units in the hospital and, as I mentioned, other areas of the hospital as well. So what have we been doing so far in terms of engaging senior leadership? We encourage the teams to send the monthly senior leader report to their medical director, and in our case, either the senior vice president or executive director for the hospital. But in addition to that, when we review the reports centrally and give feedback to the teams, we also include the senior leadership in that feedback so that they can hear or they can get a sense of what of some of the good work the team's doing, and hopefully if they haven't seen the senior leader report, that'll be an added prompt to bring those two together. we also do more summary overall updates on the collaborative work to the senior leadership, either by email and try to take advantage of kind of naturally other naturally occurring meetings where they are. Our medical directors meet monthly together. I will use that as an opportunity to, as an agenda item, to update them on this work and let them know what the teams may need help with, and similarly with other executive leadership, with other senior leadership. In terms of executive leadership, we have a lot of support from the president and leadership of the corporation. So it's also a very strong. He sends a very strong message that that this work is a priority for him and for the corporation. So I think we're very fortunate in that respect to have that kind of that support coming from the president's office. Finally, while for the first two learning sessions we really focused on getting the teams going and focusing on a lot of the basics, we have invited and have good response from our medical directors and senior vice presidents coming to our third learning session, which takes place tomorrow. So that will be another opportunity to really give them a sense not only of what their own teams are doing, but to give them a sense of what other teams are doing, which will probably help facilitate a little bit of competition among that group as well. I think as we think about engaging senior leadership, we're also, of course, thinking about ways to get their attention, and certainly the kind of the presentations and the results that get highlighted or picked up on by the medical directors and by the chief operating officers or executive directors, can differ. So I think with our set of measures have a mix of clinical outcomes as well as utilization outcomes, such as length of stay and ventilator days, and patient safety related outcomes. Patient safety is another area that's receiving very high priority attention from the executive leadership of the corporation, so this ties well with that. It also ties well, of course, with IHI's 100,000 Lives campaign, as an organization that's participating in that, it's a way of linking all these initiatives together so that it doesn't feel like a lot of disparate work going on. And certainly the other area for us to look at is how these outcomes can relate to different allocations of resources or potential cost effectiveness or cost benefits of care. And that last piece is one that we're really just beginning to start to look at as we start to see some improvements or changes in the data. But really all of these areas clearly require the data from the teams and really just emphasize that the monthly run charts, as well as the team's experiences in terms of their results from individual PDSA cycles and barriers that they're experiencing, really become the focus of the content for the senior leader meeting. There we are. Just to wrap up, our next steps for us as we think ahead is probably the first one is, again, that we continue to look at this work with respect to our entire system. So we've got some hospitals that have really taken off very well and made a lot of progress in a short period of time. We'll continue to work so we have all of the hospitals at that level of activity. And then we also have in some of our long-term care facilities patients on ventilators, for example. So there'll be some other areas of our health system that could benefit from some of the similar interventions. One of the very nice things is that there's been a very positive response to the general collaborative activities to the learning sessions, particularly, as well as the conference calls. Very positive response to a much greater level of interaction amongst the hospitals and particularly amongst the critical care directors. Greater ease with sharing experiences and troubleshooting with each other than had often occurred before. So there's a lot of support for being for an interest in continuing to maintain those kinds of opportunities for the corporation. And I think we've got some additional topics already in our list, and I'm sure more that will develop and evolve over time. Begun to look at some of the work around improving outcomes from sepsis, beginning to speak with our emergency department staff who work jointly on that area. I mentioned glycemic control is one that more of the teams are starting to look at. And then actually at our learning session tomorrow, we will begin the discussion about some of the issues related to end-of-life decision-making and how that relates and impacts to some of the other areas and measures in critical care that we're looking at. And finally, I think we will begin to look increasingly at how we kind of extend this critical work outside of the physical units, working collaboratively with the emergency department, for example, on sepsis. There was a comment just yesterday, in fact, about also needing to work collaboratively with the operating room in terms of central line bundles and as well as with staff on the floor so that we have really increased the likelihood of the same, again, common practices being applied throughout our hospital. Sepsis management will be one example of that as we look at some of the work around using rapid response teams to get critical care services out to evaluate patients on the floor. I think that's another example of kind of extending critical care outside the unit. And I think that was my final slide, so I'll stop there. And I'd be happy to take questions when you're ready.
Thanks so much, Karen. That was a great presentation of the overview of the Critical Care Collaborative. We'll take a couple of questions, and then we'll go right into the Lenox Hill Hospital team's presentation, and then we'll open it up again for more questions. Operator, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
We'll just take a couple.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, you may press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key at this time. We have a question from Mary McIntosh from Trinitas Hospital. Go ahead, please.
Just in one of the, you said something about the variations in practice across the shifts, weekends, and I just was curious how you adjusted to that, particularly with your insulin protocol.
Yeah, there were a couple of examples of that. One was part of it was recognizing that first recognizing that there was a difference, and the ICU director in that case spending a little more time with the nursing staff at night to understand what the issue was, and it seemed to very much come down to their comfort level in managing an insulin protocol and risking a patient becoming hypoglycemic when there was less easily available staff around. So he's continued to work with them in terms of raising their increasing their confidence level and working on ways for them to have feel like they have some backup that they need to be comfortable with it. So.
Are there any other questions, operator?
I'm showing no further questions at this time, ma'am. You may proceed.
Okay, great. We'll get right into Lenox Hill Hospital's presentation of their progress in the Central Line Collaborative, and then we'll open it up again for more questions for them as well as Karen again. I'm going to introduce Dr. Gerald Barr, the director of the Medical Surgical ICU at Lenox Hill, as well as Barbara Belmonte, the nurse manager of the MedSurg ICU. And are you two on the line?
Yes, we are.
Great. Thank you.
I'm Gerald Barr. I have the distinction of being the team captain here, but I first want to acknowledge all my colleagues around here with 10 other people, and we're all quite excited about this project, but the only way we could have done it is working together and communicating together. You have the PowerPoint presentation in front of you. I'm just going to review several aspects with you. The first slide gives a list of the team members. It is self-explanatory. The next slide gives you an overview of Lenox Hill Hospital. We're a 652-bed not-for-profit hospital. We're a major teaching affiliate of NYU School of Medicine, and we have residents and hundreds of residents in the Department of Medicine alone, plus medical students, plus other residency programs. And you can see we have multiple ICUs, so we have plenty of opportunity for central line insertions, plus all the other areas where we insert central lines. I'm now going to turn this over to my colleague, Barbara Belmonte, the nurse manager of the Medical Surgical ICU, who's going to give you some data relative to our progress.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having us. I'd like you to look at PowerPoint number 4, Historic Data, Central Line Associated Infections for the Medical ICU, Surgical ICU. If you look at the graph, you'll see the line at the bottom is the national average. The Haney's line is the state in the middle. And the Lenox Hill average is at the top. Regardless of what we did, we were always above the national and state average before the CLABS project. That I really wanted to highlight because we were doing well prior to this and we're continuing to do better. PowerPoint number 5 slide. I'd like you to go to bullet number 2 under performance improvement prior to the CLABS collaborative. We had started multidisciplinary rounds back in 1983. When we started looking at central lines, we integrated a lot of the members of the visiting physicians teams that were presenting lectures, fellows, and asked for their input from around the country or around the world regarding these. That was a great learning experience, and we continue to do that to this day. Going on to PowerPoint page 6, in May when we started the project, the middle of May to July 2005, look at bullet number 4. When we implemented the biopatch, our thought was to reach 100% compliance. In order to do this, we started the project by putting the patch on at the time of insertion. We continue to evaluate it, revise it, and we will continue to advise upwardly at the critical care meetings to administration on the status of that. As a result of using the biopatch on each central line, look at PowerPoint page number 7, July 2005, bullet number 3. Priority was set on the supervisory staff in medicine, surgery, and nursing to mount an awareness program. The campaign emphasized the importance of compliance, and this went along with the daily rounds. And every level of nursing and physician staff was involved in ensuring that compliance was maintained.
Hello?
Hello?
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, we seem to get some it cut off.
One, two, three, can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
Where did you, can you tell me where you didn't hear me?
We got off, we heard about May to July supervisory staff.
All right.
That was just the last one.
All right. I'm on implemented daily rounds. Checklist, page PowerPoint 8. Out in July. Learned something here in that we had vacations. And we realized that we needed to aggressively address educational needs of both the physician and nursing staff so that when the leadership was not around, this would be enforced. And we continue to do that. It's a work in progress at this date. I just want to explain the variance in that graph. Going on to implemented central line insertion checklist. You will see on the graph the hand hygiene, the maximum sterile field, chlorhexidine. The variances in May, if you look at May 16th to May 30th, we had lack of compliance with hand washing. We did a lot of counseling and awareness with the staff. And what we saw in June, July to August is hand washing remained 100% compliance. In June and July, the variance was explained that our line procedures increased and we had to increase our PAR levels to maintain the resources to the physicians for insertion of lines. To date, we have realized 100% compliance. On to central line infection data in the ICU. The take-home point on this graph is May, June, and July. Zero since we started this project. Before that, from January 2004 until May 2005, you will see that we had 1 to 2 patients a month at an average of 200 patients a month. So we are very proud of everyone being involved in this outcome. I take you to future goals.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
We have music on the line?
It's like someone may have, who's on the call with us, put it on hold. You can't put it on hold because we'll hear your hold music.
I'm sorry, ma'am. I muted that line.
Okay. If we could just hold that for now, that would be great because we hear hold music.
Yes, ma'am. I've muted the line.
Thank you.
You ready, Mike? I'm ready.
Are we betting?
Are you there, Barbara, still?
Future goals. Go to bullet number one. We plan a twofold educational campaign hospital-wide now. We are planning on a dedicated educator who will validate the initial insertion process and then do yearly competencies for physicians and nurses. We are going to achieve this outcome by working with Dr. Knapp, our administration representative that works with Dr. Barr. We will also have professional credentialing. That will be done by the department heads in medicine, surgery, anesthesia, and emergency room. Future goals, our next step is to roll out our project on the medical and surgical ICU to anesthesia. In our institution at Lenox Hill, anesthesia is the highest user of central line insertions, so we made them the priority. And then we'll go on to the emergency room and interventional radiology. The biggest emphasis in ending this presentation, I want to say throughout the program, hand washing was the key. Before you put on your gloves, hand washing. It sets the tone for the aspect of aseptic awareness. I thank you very much.
Thanks so much. That was really great. Excellent overview, and thanks for sharing all that data with us. It's just really good to see the progress that you've made. I just want to open it up right now for questions. So, operator, if you're there, we'll open up the line. Operator? Well, we have one here, so I'll take.
Hi, Hillary, this is Carrie.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? This goes out to everyone on the call today. As the call's going on, Rachel and I are emailing, and it struck me when Karen spoke and also when I was listening to Lenox Hill, there's so much education that needs to be disseminated to other shifts, and HHC had a problem with NICE. And I was just curious, and I would hope hospitals chime in, if it would be beneficial at all if this collaborative entertained doing some conference calls, if you put together teams on the night shift where we would set up a dial-in number at whatever you define as the best time, maybe 4 a.m. I think that's a quiet time on the night shift, so that we start penetrating different shifts and getting this information across to others. So I just throw that out there, and I would love any feedback, since that's a little bit of what I heard from the call today.
Operator, could we open up the lines to get comments from Terry's comment?
I don't know if Hillary wants to get up at 4 a.m., but...
I would do that. Anything for the collaborative.
And anything for the team.
We were just going back and forth trying to figure out which was better, midnight or 4 a.m. I actually voted for 4 a.m. myself. But.
Unfortunately, we seem to wake up around that time. And in my experience working in hospitals on the night shift, 4 a.m. was a little bit of a lull.
Huh.
But I think that's the whole point of this collaborative. Even though it's on central lines, we're really looking for models to disseminate information and really make radical changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes management forgets we're 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
So any, you know, feedback even on that, along with the questions, would be appreciated.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a comment or a question, you may press the 1 key at this time.
I have one here, Allison Scaduto from Greater New York.
Hi. I was just wondering, Lenox Hill, how many, on average, central lines do you insert a year? Do you know?
Dr. Barr?
Yeah, we're here. We're just trying to figure this out.
Approximate. You don't have to give me an exact.
Say 2,500 somewhere in the
But that's just for ICU, is that correct?
Yeah.
20 medical surgical ICU. Mm-hmm. 2,500 for medical surgical ICUs, but we have all these other ICUs plus anesthesia plus the emergency department.
Right.
No. We only have two patients a month.
Maybe some wrong information.
Okay.
We are happy to figure this out and let you know.
Yeah.
All right, why don't you figure it out? You can email it to me. This is Hillary, and then I'll get the information to Allison.
Okay.
And I just have I have a comment about Lenox Hill. I had the privilege of visiting with your team a couple of weeks ago, and when I walked onto the med-surg unit, I was so happy when the unit secretary asked me to wash my hands before entering and exiting the unit.
Well, we appreciate that comment. And starting in the 1980s, when there was the original problem with multi-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, we have attempted to have vigorous hand washing, and now with waterless systems, it's infinitely easier. But this is an ongoing process to educate and to re-educate all of us, including myself, about hand washing.
Well, it touched my heart. I was very happy.
Operator, are there any other questions out there or comments?
Yes, ma'am. We have a question or comment from Beth Ducey from New York University Hospital Center. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to respond to Terry's suggestion of a potential 4 a.m. call. We have rotating residents to come through, and while there is physician supervision, I think that we're going to need continuing durable educational efforts that are going to last from month to month as you get new nurses in and new physicians in. So, you know, it might be in a startup period of time you could do that, but I think that that's not going to be a realistic way of sustaining the education. I'm thinking of something more like a CD-ROM or self-learning packets or a web-based kind of an application where people could go on and come out with like a little competency test at the end of it to help. Might be something very useful.
Actually, Beth, we do have some of those tools on the Jenny website.
Okay.
I would also interject that direct observation by supervisory staff, whether it's at 4 a.m. in the morning or at 9 a.m., I'm sorry, 4 a.m. in the morning and 9 a.m. in the morning, is a very good way, especially with rotating house staff. Certainly, though, a big piece of this is nurse empowerment. And if you can have the nurse empowerment, then this can follow through because nursing is there 24/7, 365 days a year.
That's who I was actually thinking of, that the nurses were there, and sometimes they're getting secondhand information from the team. And if they know that this is really something that outside organizations are looking at, maybe the conference calls would add some value. Because it's become so evident as this project has evolved and morphed into something larger that nursing really drives the improvement to some degree.
And again, I support that they need resources or education. I just, you know, you get a crash in the unit coming in at that time, and although you've got the best laid plans, I think that the JIT, the just-in-time educational resources, have a tendency to work better because of the unpredictability sometimes of the workflow.
Absolutely, and I was just thinking this as an add-on or an adjunct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from John Holmes from New York Presbyterian. Go ahead, please.
Hi, John. Hello?
John, are you on mute?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So the I think I agree that the night is not necessarily super helpful to have that additional there, just trying to get staff to listen in. I don't have a lot of hope. I did have a lot of help out of the website pulling from different lectures when I was presenting my educational materials to the staff. So that's one way that the collaboration helped me is pull together that that presentation that I made. The for Linux Hill, I was wondering, how did you sell using the BioPatch to your hospital? Did you have resistance to starting to use that and purchasing that? And then do you do anything particular? Have you made any changes in how you maintain your lines?
Certainly in terms of the BioPatch in general, Dr. Shannon's initial presentation relative to the potential cost saving, decreased length of stay, is a very important aspect of selling this to our purchasing representative. Barbara, you want to comment on part of this also?
Well, I think the fact that it was presented in Dr. Shannon's initial presentation to us in May, and I think our thought in the educational process is that human nature being human nature and 12-hour shifts, the likelihood of 100% compliance with nurses working 13 out of 31 days, it would be less than what we would want to benchmark at. So we said we would start by initializing the insertion of the BioPatch and see where it goes. And we don't leave our lines in that long. We try daily to monitor them and get them out as soon as possible. And before the patient's transferred out, most of the triple lumens are taken out and peripheral lines are put in. As I said before, we are constantly monitoring it, and we're willing to revise it if it becomes necessary. We've had nothing but satisfaction at this point from a physician and nursing and infection control point of view. And it's not expensive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Lori Finkelstein from Mount Sinai Medical Center. Go ahead, please.
I think what I had basically was a comment to Terry's comment. in that I think based on our discussion here, you know, it's very difficult, again, to get people to rally around at night for a scheduled conference call. However, all of the conference calls are taped and on the Jenny website, and I think already, and I think that staff could be encouraged in their downtime, you know, to access the website as part of the general education that's given, and they could actually listen to the conference calls. So you don't have the same interactive potential. However, at least they'll get the information that's out there. This is just a suggestion. In terms of the validation, just while I'm on the phone, we actually and our team have developed not, you know, for the insertion validation, we're really using nurses as the monitor. However, for the catheter maintenance part of the project, which is a really big part of it as well, we've developed our catheter maintenance checklist initially was done by the nurse herself, you know, as she was going through the process. We identified in our team that, well, maybe you can't rely 100% on somebody, you know, observing themselves, if you will. And so what we're doing to get supervision involved is the nurse managers are doing sampling of each nurse and their catheter maintenance competency on a rotating basis. Each nurse will get observed. And then that will be, you know, used as sort of like a marker to see, you know, how people are doing with regard to their confidence. But that's it. That's all I have to say at the moment.
Thanks, Lori.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm showing no further questions at this time, ma'am. You may proceed.
Okay, great. As long as there's no other questions, we're about 15 more minutes to go. And we'll have Allison Scaduto present a brief update on the standardized central line kits that are being developed here at the Greater New York Services.
Hi, this is Allison Scaduto. You have the PowerPoint presentation in your packet, and we here, our goal at Greater New York is to help you find a solution to this initiative, and we want to make things as simple as possible. I just put simplicity really is the key. And if you read all the literature out there, Dr. Barinholtz had said, you know, that they reduce their CLABS by using relatively simple and inexpensive interventions as opposed to implementing more expensive interventions such as antibiotic or antiseptic catheters. So this is really what my goal was in going around to participants in this initiative and trying to put together this kit. And just as a review, the bundle is a group of best practices. All right, and one of the best practices is maximal barrier precautions. And the purpose of the barrier precautions is to maintain the sterile field, is to keep the sterility intact. Okay, and what we wanted to do was provide a kit that really limited the variation in practice. And the central line barrier kit components are, again, there's a list of components, and we made it so that you have the option of either having the kit with the biopatch or without the biopatch. And I just want to go on record as saying I think the biopatch is a fabulous product. However, it's not a magic bullet. And I think a lot of people are focusing on it, and while it's great that it has everybody talking, if people are not washing their hands, if they're not maintaining the sterile field, the biopatch is really not going to be effective in reducing your CLABS. So I just am asking you to, you know, think it through before you just make a general statement that a biopatch should be used on every body. All right. The central line barrier kits that Greater New York is going to be providing are going to be from the Premier contract, and they're, we contracted with Medical Action. And Medical Action is the only manufacturer out there that can put the biopatch inside their kit and re-sterilize. They're the only manufacturer out there that has an agreement with Biopatch to do this, and it's because they're the only manufacturer that agreed to adhere to J&J Biopatch's codes of sterilization. So if you have a kit manufacturer, and again, you know, you can use whoever you want. This is just an option that we're providing to you. If you have a kit manufacturer out there that says they can put the Biopatch inside the kit, they're really not authorized to do that. Only Medical Action is. All right. And if you're going to choose to use the Biopatch, other manufacturers, what they have to do is put it as an adjunct to the kit and put it outside the kit, and that's what makes the kits more expensive. All right. The central line barrier kits, we're going to have 6 configurations, 3 with Biopatch, 3 without Biopatch, and we're going to have 3 choices of Tegaderm, from the most simple Tegaderm to the a medium Tegaderm to the best. And, again, you're going to have choices whichever suits your needs. We're also going to have the 2 choices of ChloraPrep, a 3 ml, and we're going to have a 10 ml, and the 10 ml is the tinted kind. I was told by the ChloraPrep manufacturer that pretty soon they will have the 3 ml in the tinted. You know, again, you know, they don't have a date for that. So, you know, if you want the tinted ChloraPrep, you'll have to use the 10 ml kind. We're also going to provide a helper kit, and that would be if you have a 2-person insertion. And rather than having the barrier kit that has, you know, 2 caps, 2 gowns, 2 sets of gloves, we're just going to have a helper kit so that if you have 1 helper or 10 helpers, you don't have to keep opening up the barrier kits. You can just take the helper kits. And then we're going to provide a maintenance kit, and we're calling it the maintenance kit because that's, you know, the kit that you use to do the dressings. And, again, it's going to have 6 configurations, 3 with Biopatch, 3 without, and 3 choices of Tegaderm. Next, you know, I was not involved in the central line insertion kits. These are the Arrow kits, the Cook kits, the Edwards kits. These are the kits that actually have the central lines in them. They, the purpose of that is all the components together to enter the patient's vessel, and that would be the lidocaine, the safety sharps, which include the safety hypodermic, the safety scalpels. So, again, you'll have the barrier kit to prepare the patient, the central line insertion kit to actually insert the catheter. All right, the next slide is, you know, what could be put into the central line insertion kit. All right. And then the next slide is, you know, just a few different manufacturers. And those, as I've gone around to the different hospitals, everybody has their different nuances that they would like in their kits. So, you know, again, you'll have to contact your, you know, your Arrow, your Edwards, your Cook representative to design those kits. But try to keep them as simple as possible. The maintenance kit components, again, they're going to be the masks, the gloves, the drape, the alcohol swabs, ChloraPrep, Biopatch if you want it, and large transparent dressing, and some tape. I was told by one of the infection control practitioners, I think it was at Lenox Hill, that there is a new APIC recommendation or guideline that says that you should change your gloves twice during the dressing change. Once to take the dressing off, wash your hands again, put a new pair of gloves on, and then to redress the site. And again, you know, to reiterate, simplicity is the key. And, you know, there, we're recommending, you know, just four kits, the barrier kit, the helper kit, insertion kit, and maintenance. And if you need any more information on these kits, please contact me, or and I will put you in touch with the medical action representative, or have your materials manager contact me. Okay?
Are there any questions for Allison about this?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the 1 key at this time. Our next question is from Michelle Coons from Long Island College. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michelle.
Michelle? Michelle's here.
Go ahead with your question, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I didn't press number one. You're on, though.
Okay. Do you have a question? Do you have a question?
No, we're learning a lot, though. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Diane Baranowitz from Stanford Hospital.
Hi. Thank you very much. Everything has been very informative. I have a question regarding the helper kit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recommend that that be sterile?
Oh, yes, definitely.
It do. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane.
I appreciate and I agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm showing no further questions at this time, ma'am. You may proceed.
Great. Thanks very much. First, I just want to thank all the speakers today, Karen Scott Collins and Dr. Barr and Barbara Belmonte, all really great informative presentations. Sometimes we get people who ask me questions later. If that happens, I may be emailing one or two of you to find out if you could give more information. And thanks, Allison, for the update on the central line kits. We only have a few minutes. I just wanted to give a brief summary of the team and senior leader reports that we got in August. Really great information on them. They're just getting better and better each month. We got about 62%. We got about, of the people in the, of the hospitals in the collaborative, we got about 62% of reports. So I will be sending my email soon asking some of the day-to-day contacts for the reports. We did include a handout with the types of reports, just an overview of what kinds of things that we saw. I won't go through it a lot, but one thing I do want to say about that, there's a lot of educational activities going on where nurses, attendings, and house staff are educated on different items that are on the Jenny website, including Dr. Shannon's presentation, some of the collab's kickoff materials. We've heard that a lot of the conference call archives are being used, which is great. And just there's some presentations that are being done out there on implementation of the bundle. Another thing that I did notice, we're seeing more and more data from the PDSA cycles, which we think is great, too. A lot of that is on the compliance with the bundle and the dressing change and the daily goals in multidisciplinary rounds. Finally, another big topic this time was use of the daily goal sheets during interdisciplinary rounds and actually modifying the forms based on the feedback during interdisciplinary rounds. So that's pretty much a really brief overview of the kinds of reports. If you want more detail as to what other members of the collaborative are doing, please don't hesitate to call me about that. And then there's a few other housekeeping topics. Terry and Rachel, I don't know if you want me to talk a little bit about the learning session on the 19th. Okay.
That's fine, Hillary.
Okay.
I think it's good to just continue to promote it.
Okay. Just one thing that we were thinking of doing was a poster session for that. So if any of you want to volunteer to make a poster for the session, that would be great. If not, I'll be calling some of you to see if I can help you put together a poster for it. Again, Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury and Alcoa CEO, will be the keynote speaker along with some of the other people that worked on the Pittsburgh Regional Healthcare Collaborative. So that's pretty much the update for that. We will be sending out a notice to you toward the middle of September with detailed information on that session. One other thing that we just wanted to let you know, we're going to be submitting to hospital CEOs CLABS progress report. Just as Karen Scott Collins pointed it out, it's really important to get senior leadership involved. That report will include some of your data, and we'll share that with you as well. Obviously, it will talk about progress to date, next steps, and how to involve senior leadership in collaboratives like this. We hope to send that out, I'm just going to say, sometime during the month of September, mid to late September. Finally, we're putting together a survey. We want to see how the CLABS collaborative is going. So that survey will really ask you what you think of the conference calls, what you think of the website, and what other kinds of information we can get for you. Some of you have been calling us and saying, well, I want to learn more about what kind of evidence exists with regard to line maintenance. So that's something we want to hear comments like that, and we'll try to get speakers on future calls for topics like that. And finally, before I open it up one more time for question and answers, the next conference call is going to feature Peter Pronovost and Brian Sexton from Johns Hopkins Patient Safety Group, and they're going to really talk about the culture of safety in the ICU and how they use the Safety Attitudes Questionnaire to measure the culture and improve it. Unless there's anything from Terry or Rachel, I'll open it one more time for questions.
Just on that next conference call, to emphasize to folks, we are really privileged to get Dr. Pronovost and his colleagues on for this conference call, and would just encourage you to advertise this to as many people, including folks who may not be directly involved in the project at this point, who might otherwise be interested in this whole issue of the culture of safety and its relationship to quality improvement and safety efforts. We think this is going to be a really terrific call, so we just wanted to emphasize that we're really privileged to get them and to encourage as many people as you can to participate.
Thanks, Rachel. I should have also pointed out, too, that we did apply for continuing education credit for this call. It's still pending, but we did apply for it. So advertise it widely. Operator, any questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key at this time.
Or is it collaborative? Can you just get into the Jenny website?
Yes. I'm showing no questions at this time, ma'am. You may proceed.
Okay, great. And look at that. We are right on time, 4:30. Thanks so much for your participation. As always, just give us a call if you need anything from us.
Thanks, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's program. This concludes the conference. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.